Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Liz Palka reporting. The Pentagon downplayed Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement of new nuclear weapons on Thursday. A Pentagon spokeswoman says Moscow's weaponry was long under development and had already been factored into U.S. assessments. Here's Dana White.
We're not surprised by the statement, and the American people should rest assured that we are fully prepared.
In his annual State of the Nation address earlier on Thursday, Putin boasted about his military's newfound capabilities, including invincible nuclear weapons that cannot be intercepted. The Russian leader emphasized that the development of new weapons that have no equivalent in the West came in response to the U.S. withdrawal from a Cold War-era treaty banning missile defenses and U.S. efforts to develop a missile defense system. Here's more from White.
Our missile defense has never been about them. We need to ensure we have a credible nuclear deterrent. And we are confident that we're prepared to do, and we're prepared to defend this nation no matter what.
The U.S. State Department has approved the possible sale of Javelin missiles and launch units to Ukraine. It would come at an estimated cost of $47 million, the Pentagon said Thursday. A statement read the Javelin system would help Ukraine build its long-term defense capacity. More than 10,000 people have been killed since 2014 in a conflict that pits Ukrainian forces against Russian-backed separatists in eastern Ukraine. Bangladesh has requested that Myanmar withdraw its security forces from their common border. More on VOAnews.com. This is VOA News. This is the third and possibly last day of a Russia-ordered five-hour humanitarian pause in the fighting in the eastern Ghouta area of Syria. The Union of Medical Care and Relief Organizations members say the fighting has worsened. This since the UN Security Council 30-day ceasefire resolution was adopted on Saturday. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA.
The chairman of the organization, Ghanem Tayara, says the resolution has been completely ignored.
There have been more than 90 persons killed. There have been so many frequent attacks on medical facilities, on hospitals, airstrikes, shelling, bombing.
Additionally, Tayara says one child has died and 19 other people sickened from a chlorine gas chemical attack by Syrian government forces. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Nearly 600 people have died and more than 1,000 wounded in the last 2 weeks. A German national has been captured for working for the Taliban. The Afghan Ministry of Defense confirmed Thursday that a video circulating on social media of the captured foreign fighter is authentic. The German national has worked for the Taliban for more than 8 years. Police officials have not revealed the person's identity, but say the suspect was a Taliban advisor. They were arrested during a raid on a suspected Taliban bomb-making compound. A blackout hit Puerto Rico's capital and surrounding areas on Thursday after two of the main power plants shut down. It's a failure that came amid warnings from officials that the power company is struggling to remain operational. Puerto Rico's Electric Power Authority tweeted the plants shut down to protect the electrical system. Shop owners in Old San Juan said this power outage, plus many others, are crippling their businesses. That's coffee shop owner Hector Andujar explaining he saw two cruise ships docked at the pier. As tourists walk by and see his restaurant dark, they keep walking. More than 15% of power customers remain in the dark nearly 6 months after Hurricane Maria. The September storm destroyed two-thirds of the island's power distribution system. And British Prime Minister Theresa May will set out her vision on Friday for a Brexit deal deeper and wider than, quote, any free trade agreement anywhere in the world, telling the European Union it is in their shared interest. In this much-anticipated speech, which the EU hopes will offer more details. I'm Liz Palka.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, March 2nd, and here are some of the stories we are covering. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa makes his first foreign visit today to Angola.
Mr. Ramaphosa will visit Angola in his capacity of chair of the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC. The main topics in this meeting, of course, will be the Lesotho crisis.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai in Luanda. Zimbabwe's opposition MDC chooses its candidate for this year's presidential election, but there is disagreement within the party. A lawsuit has been filed challenging the legitimacy of Zimbabwe President Emmerson Mnangagwa. And Amazon troop contributing countries call for more funding for the mission.
That is why it is essential.
We'll examine the human rights issues in next week's Sierra Leone presidential election. And a visit next week by Benin's president may pose the first test for France's promise to return African art treasures, those stories. Plus, Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa is today, Friday, making his first foreign visit since becoming President. Ramaphosa, who is the current chair of the Southern African Development Community, SADC, will first stop in Angola and then on to Botswana on Saturday. He will meet with Angolan President João Lourenço, who is chair of the SADC organ on politics, defense, and security cooperation. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Paivai says, high on the two leaders' agenda is the situation in the Kingdom of Lesotho, where SADC has deployed troops since last December to ease security concerns brought on by the killing last September of the country's top army chief.
Mr. Ramaphosa will visit Angola in his capacity of chair of the Southern Africa Development Community, SADC, and will meet his counterpart, President João Lourenço, which serves the politics, defense, and security body. The main topics in this meeting, of course, will be the Lesotho crisis after this country has been triggered by the last November murder of the army chief, which forces the SADC to send the military troops there. Another topic will be the drought, which now is affecting several Southern African countries. And of course, in this very first but short visit, Mr. Ramaphosa also will have the opportunity to discuss with President João Lourenço the increase of bilateral relations between South Africa and Angola, which are the most important countries in the region.
And Mario, the state-owned oil company, Sonangol, has been in the news lately now. I'm reading that it is also to build more refineries. What can you tell us about Sonangol in the news in Angola?
In fact, so last Wednesday, the recently appointed chairman of Sonangol Group, Mr. Carlo Saturnino, gave his very first press conference after 100 days in charge of this powerful Angolan company. But I will underline one of the things that are making noises, not only here in Angola, but international, is that Mr. Saturnino, the Sonangol chairman, has accused the former administrations to put out of the country $38 million US dollars, even after the former board chief of Sonangol, Mrs. Isabel dos Santos, has been fired, which is supposed to be illegal. This kind of criticism against the daughter of the former president are making some noises here in Angola. But until now, nothing legal succeeds. Mr. Saturnino also underlines that the net profit of Sonangol was $224 million in 2017, just $81 million in the previous years when the oil prices were lower.
Mario, before I let you go, the Angolan National Assembly is to be considering pretty soon a law on abortion, and it will make abortion a crime except in the case when the life of the pregnant woman is in danger. What can you tell us?
Yes, it's true. We must take into account that the Catholic Church in Angola is quite powerful and make a lot of pressures on the government and the ruling party, MPLA, to maintain the criminalization of the vote. I must also remember that despite that, there was in the past a strong demonstrations from women against this kind of situation. And we expect in the next Women's World Day, 8th of March, so there will be another demonstration when these questions will be arisen by the Angolan women.
Mario, it's always nice to talk with you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mario Alpaivai is a veteran Angolan journalist. He was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. Zimbabwe's main opposition, Movement for Democratic Change, MDC, on Thursday chose Nelson Chamisa as its candidate in this year's presidential election. The 40-year-old Chamisa rose through the MDC leadership ladder as the party's youth wing leader. This year's election will be the MDC's first major test since the death last month of its leader, Morgan Tsvangirai, and the removal of Zimbabwe's founding president, Robert Mugabe. But the uphill battle to defeat the ruling ZANU-PF party is being compounded by disagreement within the MDC ranks over the selection of Mr. Chamisa. Dan Moyo is chairperson of the MDC USA branch. He said Chamisa's appointment as party standard bearer was done without consultation.
I must say that it is disappointing that this appointment comes at a time when there is serious disunity in the party, where most party members and structures of the party were not consulted, and part of the decision to elect Mr. Chamisa were senior, where there is no unity amongst the senior members of the party, starting from the National Standing Committee of the party down to the branches on the ground. I personally find it very disturbing that a man of Mr. Chamisa's stature, who is a man of law as well as a man of the cloth, since he is a pastor, would find it in himself to proceed and get himself appointed as the candidate for the party in a process that is so flawed and not inclusive of all stakeholders of the party. I think it has brought disarray to the party, and we're going into an election as a divided house.
So, Mr. Moyo, the MDC has been in opposition for a long time. One would say if the division you are talking about is the disagreement over this election of Mr. Chamisa is true, then the MDC might as well give the upcoming election to Mr. Emmerson Mnangagwa of ZANU-PF.
I am afraid that is how it is looking at this moment. Unless normalcy can come back to the party and people can sit down in a sober fashion and follow the party constitution, then I don't think any of these problems would suffice. There's absolutely nothing wrong and out of place with calling for a democratic process to elect a president of the party who's going to be the candidate in the elections. Our constitution provides for that, and unfortunately that has not been followed in this instance.
It seems to me if this is not resolved, then would you tell me that the MDC would be ready for election or it wouldn't be ready?
It definitely would not be ready at the state that it is in right now. Remember that the elected Vice President, Thokozani Kuphe, represents a very large constituency of the MDC stronghold, which is the region of Matabeleland. And if that region of Matabeleland feels that procedures were not followed and Thokozani Kuphe was pushed out in an unconstitutional manner, I do not see how they are all going to come out and vote for Chamisa. So we have created a problem for ourselves.
Dan Moyo is chairperson of the USA branch of Zimbabwe's main opposition movement for democratic change. He was speaking with me from Washington, D.C. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, the second day of March. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. Three Zimbabweans filed a lawsuit late Thursday in the country's constitutional court challenging the legitimacy of President Emmerson Mnangagwa. As Sebastian Mofu reports from Harare, the litigants say they want a transitional authority appointed by parliament to run the country until next election.
In an interview, Linda Masarira, one of the three litigants, said they did not want Zimbabwe's former president, Robert Mugabe, ousted last November, reinstated.
What we want the court to do is to allude to the fact that the coup was a coup and that the military actually violated the constitution of this country. We have actually put in a provisional order for the illegitimate government to be dissolved and parliament to set up a national transitional authority that will run the country from the day of the order until the day of elections. Because clearly we cannot have the military commanding our elections. There will be no free and fair elections in that respect.
President Emmerson Mnangagwa was sworn in last November. That was after the resignation of Mugabe following pressure from the military, thus ending his 37-year rule of Zimbabwe. President Mnangagwa has since promised free, fair and credible elections this year, which the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission says will be held between July and August. Over the weekend, Mugabe told a private gathering celebrating his 94-year birthday that President Mnangagwa was illegally in office as the army forced him to resign. Interestingly, Mugabe is one of the respondents in the application challenging the legitimacy of President Mnangagwa. Zimbabwe's Constitutional Court is yet to set a hearing date for the case. Sebastian Mofu for VOA News, Harare.
Troop contributing countries of the African Union mission in Somalia, also known as AMISOM, are calling on the African Union and international partners to support the mission. Sam Kutesa, Uganda's Minister of Foreign Affairs, warns the mission might lose the gains it has made unless it is strengthened.
In his speech to foreign affairs ministers and ministers of defense from AMISOM contributing members, Minister Kutesa started by outlining the achievements the mission has had in the last 11 years.
These are and include the Somali government previously based out of the country has been based in Mogadishu for a long time now. International organizations, including the United Nations, have also relocated to Mogadishu. More than 80% of Al-Shabaab-dominated areas have been liberated. The threat of piracy at sea that threatened international shipping and trade has been neutralized. Business is thriving and there are many reconstruction activities in many parts of the country, and we have witnessed regular elections that have been held.
The UN Security Council last year passed a resolution calling for a phased withdrawal of AMISOM troops from Somalia and eventual handover of management of security to the country's force. But Kutesa says the Somali army must be left in a position when it can effectively perform its duties.
As we all know, AMISOM was never intended to be in Somalia forever. That is why it is essential that the government of Somalia accelerates efforts and is supported to shoulder its responsibility in providing security for its people. It is crucial that the drawdown of AMISOM is synchronized with the corresponding strengthening of Somali security forces. The failure to carefully manage this process would imperil the political and security gains already made.
Kutesa says the mission still has inadequate troop numbers and lacks sustainable funding. Ismail Charugai, the Africa Union Commissioner for Peace and Security, agrees.
There is broad agreement on the need for a comprehensive approach to transition and the need to identify SNSF elements that will be responsible for implementing the transition plan. The core group meeting is expected to finalize a realistic, phased, and condition-based draft transition plan before the end of March 2018. The primary focus of the Africa Union in the coming period should then be supported.
SNAF stands for the Somali National Armed Forces, the Somali National Army. At least 29 people were killed and dozens more wounded after a double car bomb blast in the Somali capital last week. AMISOM was established to work with the Somali army to reduce the threat posed by Al-Shabaab and other armed opposition groups. The troop contributing countries, the AMISOM, are Burundi, Djibouti, Ethiopia, Kenya and Uganda, while the police contributing countries are Kenya, Ghana, Nigeria, Sierra Leone as well as Uganda. For VOA News, I am Mugume, Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Sierra Leoneans go to the polls next Wednesday to elect a successor to President Ernest Bai Koroma, who is stepping down after a decade in power. Many issues, including the economy and corruption, are dominating the campaign. Amnesty International West Africa researcher Sabrina Matani, who is in Freetown, spoke to Ricky Stryak about the human rights issues that are being discussed by the contenders.
There are some NGO regulations which were passed in secret in November, and this was only made public very recently, a few weeks ago. Lots of civil society groups have come out against these regulations. They're very restrictive. They give the government a lot of power to control what NGOs do, to review budgets, policies. And this, of course, makes it very difficult, especially for NGOs who might be working on things which are in opposition to the government. And two of the UN special rapporteurs, the one on freedom of expression and one on protection of human rights defenders, released a statement to the government urging them to revise them and saying that they actually didn't conform with international human rights obligations. There's no impact of the regulations right now because they're not being enforced, because it's an election time. But lots of groups are calling on whoever comes to power after the election to really consider revising these, because otherwise it's going to really clamp down on civil society, which is very vibrant in Sierra Leone.
I know today there is scheduled a women debate in Freetown among some of the female candidates. What are some of the women's rights issues in regards to human rights that are being discussed in this run-up to the election?
In particular, women are really disappointed. The gender equality bill was put before government in 2007, and over 10 years later, it's still not been passed. And this would have allowed 30% quotas for women in political spheres. And we see the impact of not having this even now. In this election, there's still very few women who are contending and contesting. There's only one presidential candidate who's a woman. And so I think in the debate tonight, this issue is still going to be very much, you know, at the front of saying, how are we going to get and encourage more women into politics? Because if we want to change things, we really need women to be in these leadership roles. And then secondly, I think there'll be a lot of debate around FGM. There's been a temporary ban on FGM during the election. And also things like safe abortion. Current government did not pass a safe abortion bill. And Sierra Leone has a very high rate of maternal mortality. And then lastly, the government also introduced a very controversial ban on pregnant girls from going to school and taking exams.
That was Sabrina Matani, a West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. She was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Sierra Leone's capital, Freetown. French President Emmanuel Macron's groundbreaking promise to return colonial-era artifacts to Africa may face its first test next week when he holds talks in Paris with his Beninese counterpart, Patrice Talon. At issue are treasures from the former kingdom of Dahomey, which ended up in French museums and private collections. As Lisa Bryan reports for VOA from Paris, the practicalities of repatriation are both complicated and controversial.
The Quai Branly Museum in Paris holds thousands of African artifacts. Quelle masks from Gabon, Cameroon, and Republic of Congo, Baole and Dan sculptures from Côte d'Ivoire, and royal Dahomey artifacts from what is modern-day Benin. Like those elsewhere in Europe, France's top public museum for African art is now reconsidering its collection amid rising questions about whether some of it was looted or otherwise unfairly acquired from former colonies. Restitution claims are not new, but now President Emmanuel Macron is giving them new impetus. During a keynote speech in Ouagadougou last November, he said Africa's cultural heritage could no longer remain in European museums and private collections. Over the next 5 years, he said, artifacts in France must be temporarily or permanently returned to Africa. In 2016, Benin became the first African country to ask France for its artifacts back. Several thousand pieces taken from the former Kingdom of Dahomey by French soldiers and missionaries. A number ended up at Quai Branly. But the answer by the previous French administration was no. The art was now French property. Beninois like Marie-Cécile Zinsou reject that argument. She heads the Zinsou Foundation in Cotonou, which promotes African art.
Benin heritage is shown in France. It's shown in New York. It's shown in London. It's shown in Berlin. The only place where you can't see it is Benin, because the French, they left with everything.
There's also a powerful economic dimension. Art attracts tourists, like the millions coming to Paris each year. And tourists, notes Louis-Georges Tain, bring money. Tain heads CRAN, an umbrella group of French Black associations and a key restitution campaigner.
If you want tourists to come to your country, you need to have a cultural legacy to show to the world. And how can you do that when most of your legacy has been robbed by many people in the Western countries?
Some critics argue African art is now universal patrimony and that many African countries don't have the facilities to house old and fragile artifacts. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. Very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin with the record transfer fee paid for Democratic Republic of Congo striker Cedric Bakambu, who now owns the title as the most expensive African footballer of all time after completing a $19 million move to Chinese Super League club Beijing Guoan from Villarreal. Bakambu upset Gabon striker Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang as Africa's most expensive player. Aubameyang moved to Arsenal from Borussia Dortmund for $77 million after penning a four-year contract in January.
I'm very happy to be here in my new team, and I hope we will make a very good season, and good luck for us.
Staying with football news, one of Africa's five representatives to the summer 2018 Russia World Cup, the Super Eagles of Nigeria, has downplayed the possibility of lifting the most prized trophy in world football. Coach of the Super Eagles of Nigeria, General Rao, says the dream of winning the World Cup is a good one, but football fans in Nigeria must be realistic.
When you want to dream and you have the right to dream, you can say that we can win, everybody can win. But if you are realistic, we are number 52 in FIFA ranking. It would be a wonderful surprise if Nigeria could come already until the quarter or semi-final and to the final. But let's dream and let's hope to do the best.
And now to rugby news. Rassie Erasmus has been confirmed as the new head coach of South Africa's national rugby team, the Springboks, on an unusually long six-year contract, with the former Springboks loose forward given the chance to lead the team through the next two Rugby World Cups in 2019 and 2023. Rassie Erasmus, who played 36 tests for the Springboks from 1997 to 2001 and captained his country in one test, replaced Alistair Kozie, who left as head coach last month, halfway through his contract, following a dismal 2 years' performance.
I've been in the setup since the beginning, and I know what the targets are and what the challenges are and what the obstacles are. And you know, I really think we can make a hell of a contribution. And I wouldn't have taken the job if I thought there was something that's going to stop us from performing.
In table tennis news, Kenyan duo of Sejal Taka and Brian Mutua have been eliminated from the International Table Tennis Federation Africa Continental Cup, which got underway in Nairobi on Thursday. The Kenyans each lost their opening two preliminary round matches at the Kasarani Gymnasium. The three-day event has attracted 32 top players from Africa. The top two players in the male and female category in the tournament will represent Africa in next year's World Table Tennis Championships in Budapest, Hungary. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, March 2nd edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Music time in Africa. Savor the flavor of African music. Hi, I'm Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Tune in feast your ears and dig in to an hour of amazing Pan-African music, featured interviews, and music news. Music Time in Africa, Friday at 0900 and Saturday and Sunday at 0900, 15, 20, and 2200 hours UTC.